The world always wants us dead. Disabled people know that every day of our lives. The world doesn't want us around and wants us dead. So if you want to call that anger, I call it kind of drive. You know, you have to be willing to thrive or you're not going to make it.
What does the term disabled mean to you?
It has a lot of different meanings to me, I think. I mean, there's physically disabled, emotionally disabled, mentally disabled. I'm sure there's more disabilities than that than I can think of.
Well, we all have our limitations. Disability is such a broad term. It means certain things that you can't, physically do or mentally get over it.
To me, it means some kind of a limitation that is ongoing, permanent, and keeps a person from functioning normally day to day.
To most people, disability means that there's a physical problem. And people sometimes don't accept the emotional part of people. So I don't hide it. But I only share with those that are close to me.
I have some limitations as far as, I have some back problems, issues, and knees and whatnot, but hopefully you can try to overcome it, your disabilities, and that should be a feel-good moment for you.
What made me not able to work about 4 or 5 years ago was, if I can think of it, we may have to pause. The diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment. So I was unable to remember things. I couldn't calculate in my head anymore. I just couldn't keep up with the demands of my job.
Welcome to Elders, Season 3 of Gray Area. I'm Julie Reynolds. This episode is titled Travels with Corbett. This season, we're hearing from elder survivors of injustice and historical trauma. These elders have made social justice history, but they're not done yet. They're showing new generations what they've learned about how to address and prevent systemic harm. In 2021, I converted a minivan into a camper and took to the road with my chocolate lab, Atlas. The voices you just heard are some of the van-dwelling people I've met while traveling the last 4 years. You might not know it, but many people who live life on the road still manage to live in deep community. There are known spots and frequent meetups that make it easy to get to know and become a familiar face. During my travels, I find myself drawn again and again to the southwestern U.S., to places where people living in vehicles gather each winter to live rent-free in the desert warmth.
Everybody has something that attracts them.
Today, I'm parked in the Sonoran Desert to join some friends at an informal 2-week event called Van Aid. Here, volunteers install solar panels, water systems, whatever anyone needs done to their home on wheels.
The phrase that's most commonly used is nomads coming together to help other nomads.
That's Van Aid volunteer Gary Bowen. He's a nomad himself.
We have people coming in with a lot of needs. Some people need heaters, some people need ventilation, some people need a bed platform. We try to address the most pressing needs that are really going to improve the quality of people's lives in their rigs.
Another volunteer nomad is a woman from Berkeley named Ann Kozitsky, who holds court every day around her truck camper. She's always offering dinner, friendship, and support to anyone dropping by.
So if you come back either later today or tomorrow, certainly tomorrow,
okay,
we'll work some more and we'll get it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. It was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Have a good day.
I know, I'm so weird.
As a retired nurse, she set up a first aid station next to her van to help anyone who asks.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry it hurts. 130 over 68. That's good.
Really?
What do you know what yours normally runs?
I haven't taken
Anne and several other campers keep telling me I have to sit down and talk with a van-dwelling, queer, disabled elder named Corbett. I've met lots of interesting people here, but none with a story like hers.
My name is Corbett Joan O'Toole, and I'm agreeing to be recorded.
So you told me quite a bit the other day. I'd love to hear that White House thing again, and the federal building, all of that kind of stuff. But let's just start with you and what's important to you.
So I'm 72 years old. I live full-time as a nomad. And what's become important to me as I've aged is, what are the ways that I can bring peace to the world and keeping it pretty local for me? I've seen our communities decimated, so many different communities. And I decided I was going to do two things. One was that I was going to listen to the women of color. I'm a white woman. I was going to follow their lead. Felt like they had a really long view of how to be effective and how to make a difference and how to do it from the perspective of deep community grounding. And then the other decision I made is I'm only going to do what's right in front of me. If it crosses my path, it's my responsibility to step up.
Like Corbett, people at Van Aid are here to get help and pay it forward. Volunteers are helping to rebuild the inside of her 2011 Ford Econoline van, and they're also installing a new wheelchair lift. One of those volunteers is a Minnesotan named Brenda Zorn, who sold her house a couple of years ago to live full-time in her converted passenger van. Chatting with Brenda is Kyle Chapman, an artist and former general contractor who now builds nomadic homes and off-grid power systems.
Last year, Van Aid, I had the privilege of meeting Corbett, who you might have heard of, and sort of in a pinch, I ended up doing a little build-out in the van that she had. It was really a fun project because we got to consider the needs of the person using the van more than we do with most builds. This was an opportunity to really take on a challenge and adapt a space even more to the user of the space.
I saw it when it was finished. It was beautiful.
I thought it was really quite something considering the short time frame we had to work on it.
And it met her needs perfectly.
I wanted my van to have three zones: a mudroom area, a bed, kind of quiet area, some storage. I wanted my front to be my work area. Eating, writing, all that stuff.
Corbett is not out here enjoying some golden years type of retirement in a Winnebago. This van is the only home she knows.
The presumption that I could kick back is actually not an actual reality. My community is disabled people and poor people that are minimally housed. They can't take somebody else in or the place isn't accessible. I tried for 5 years to get on a housing list and I could not stay housed in that world. And I'm happy out here.
As a polio survivor, lifelong activist, and self-described elder, like Dr. John Spence and others you'll meet this season, Corbett helped make history during California's dynamic civil rights era. After meeting her, I find myself thinking more and more about the disability rights movement I experienced as a young adult living in Berkeley in the 70s. I didn't know her then, but Corbett and her peers were changing history. And it never occurred to me that their movement had anything to do with me. Even Corbett, who uses a wheelchair lift to get in and out of her van, didn't always identify as disabled, or disabled enough to be part of that community. Before the sky-high price of Bay Area real estate forced her to live in a vehicle, Corbett's life could be described as storied. She was born in 1951 and grew up in an Irish Catholic household in the Boston area. At 12 months, she got polio, just a few years before vaccines would become widely available. She's used mobility aids ever since.
When I was a kid, I had steel leg braces and I wore a corset because I have a weak abdomen and wooden crutches. So I was always marked. I never went a day without being stared at. And often people saying to me, "What's wrong with you?" as part of the staring. It was literally an every single day experience.
When Corbett grew up in the 50s, many U.S. cities still had so-called ugly laws on the books, laws that literally criminalized being visibly disabled in public. A holdout from the eugenics movement, the nation's first ugly law was passed in San Francisco in 1867. It made it illegal for, quote, "any person who is diseased, maimed, mutilated, or deformed in any way so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object, to expose himself or herself to public view." For centuries, Western culture has largely addressed disability with banishment and confinement. But in the early 20th century, attitudes shifted toward institutionalization and elimination, echoing the treatment of indigenous people. Cities like Denver, Omaha, New Orleans, Chicago, Portland, and even the entire state of Pennsylvania followed with more ugly laws. For more than 100 years, people were incarcerated and fined for the crime of ugliness. The exception was traveling to or from work, which for many physically disabled or different people was only possible within so-called freak shows that were popular at the time. Although the nation's ugly laws were eventually repealed, the last known arrest was as recent as 1974, when a homeless man was charged in Omaha because he had visible scars on his body. Corbett's family, though, had a different attitude. With FDR as a model, she was expected to go to public school and be part of her community.
My mom had set the tone. You belong in society, and that's the way it's going to be. Like, I was part of the world. That was the family ethos. You're just another kid. The trade-off was I was always alone. You know, I was the only one that was different.
She spent summers at Camp Caravan, a place for kids with disabilities in South Royalston, Massachusetts. The program was pioneering for its time, founded by Ed McCarty, who started one of the country's first special education programs in Somerville, near Boston. Camp Caravan was a predecessor to New York's Camp Jened, where scores of disabled youth were empowered in the 60s and 70s. Camp Jened was commemorated in the documentary Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution, which shows how these camps laid the groundwork for the thriving disabled communities that emerged in the following decades. Her own summers at Camp Caravan reinforced Corbett's belief that she and the broader disabled community had as much to offer the world as anyone else.
I was treated in a way that I wasn't treated in the city. And I discovered that I could talk about stuff I couldn't talk about with my non-disabled siblings or in my non-disabled world. So even though it was really separated from the rest of the world, I was also being grounded in this sense of that I was okay. That who I was okay, that I had gifts to give, that other people had gifts to give, and how they looked or how they sounded or how they communicated was not the main issue.
As a young adult, Corbett made her way to Berkeley, California, where she was stunned to find an activist disabled community. The Center for Independent Living, the first such center in the country organized and operated by people with disabilities, opened on Telegraph Avenue in 1972.
And all of a sudden, I arrive in Berkeley in 1972, and the horizons just, there was no limit to the horizons. So it was probably 1973, UC Berkeley was hosting an International Women's Day celebration, and in the hallway, there were a bunch of tables. And I see this one for a disabled women's group. And I was walking just with a cane at that point, and I remember walking back and forth many times. And I literally walked up to Susan Siegel, who later got a MacArthur, and who runs Mobility International USA now. And she at that point, she was a UC Berkeley student, and I walked up to her, and I waited till nobody was around, and I literally said the words, "I don't really know if I'm disabled enough for your group, but could I have some information?" And that changed my life. That literally set the trajectory. I don't know if I'm disabled enough for your group, because I didn't know what disabled meant. I had been in isolation. I mean, I had friends from camp, but we didn't talk to each other when we weren't at camp. We didn't, like, write to each other or anything. So I had no idea what she meant.
Few Americans did, but that was beginning to change. The disability community emerged amid the growing civil rights movement, coalescing groups that had largely been isolated. The 1975 film adaptation of Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest swept the Academy Awards that year, offering for the first time in mainstream American culture what Corbett calls the visual vocabulary of disabled life and the abject horrors of institutionalization.
Jesus, I mean, you guys do nothing but complain about how you can't stand it in this place here, and then you haven't got the guts just to walk out. What do you think you are, for Christ's sake, crazy or something? Well, you're not. You're not. You're no crazier than the average asshole out walking around on the streets, and that's it.
nothing was actually accessible. There were no curb cuts on the street. There was no accessible transportation. You couldn't get into City Hall. You couldn't get into a courtroom. You couldn't get in any place if you needed a wheelchair. You didn't have a right to an interpreter in any environments. Nothing was in Braille. And people are starting to say, why don't we have curb cuts? Why are we in wheelchairs rolling down the streets with the cars? Why don't we have interpreters? And so the fight started to be with the city councils, and then with the state, and then with the feds.
As I get to know Corbett, I'm learning she was part of a powerful movement that ultimately led to the Americans with Disabilities Act and other reforms that many of us take for granted today.
Did they think the fairies came and made curb cuts? Just went bling, little Tinkerbell, bling. Like, how do they think the change happened? Why is there an interpreter on the screen during an emergency? Why is there captioning?
Those changes happened in large part because of the successful 1977 occupation of San Francisco's Federal Building. Corbett and roughly 150 disabled colleagues occupied federal offices for 28 days, the longest sit-in at a federal building in U.S. history. It's called the 504 sit-in because protesters refused to leave until a regulation prohibiting discrimination in federally funded programs on the basis of disability was signed into law. That was Section 504, a long-stalled part of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, and Corbett was there, alongside legendary disability activists such as Kitty Cohn, Judy Heumann, and Brad Lomax.
Proud and defiant, 500 to 600 people in wheelchairs with walking canes and hearing aids stormed the Regional Office of Health, Education, and Welfare in San Francisco. Their purpose? To stop discrimination against the disabled, no matter what the consequences.
Here's Corbett recalling the event in a StoryCorps interview, speaking to her friend and fellow activist Stacy Park Milburn. We'll hear more about Stacy in a bit.
So when 1977 came, I had already spent a few years basically partying. You know, the Center for Independent Living was, if you read the history, we were all very serious. But if you were there, it was lots of partying because nothing was accessible in those days. So, you know, we were each other's transportation and lovers and friends and drug dealers in the whole nine yards. Everything was kind of a big mush. But we also knew that different people had different knowledge. So if you wanted to talk about disabled women's issues, you came to me. And Judy Heumann was like the national legislative person, and if you wanted to know about national legislative stuff, Judy was the one that informed us. So in 1976, Judy came and said, the national disability organizations are starting to mumble that we have to put our foot down about 504.
A handicap demands that Section 504 be signed. The Ford administration never implemented the act. And now the new HEW secretary, Joseph Califano, says he will sign it in May. The handicapped want him to sign it now.
And I'm like, whatever. And she said, and we might have to take some action. And I'm like, whatever. Party in a new location? Okay with me.
I will sign a set of 504 regulations by early May.
Now?
I will do it
now. Not May, now.
And fast forward to February. In February, the national organizations gave an ultimatum to Carter, President Carter, and said, you've got to sign these regulations or else. And April, the regulations weren't signed. And so Judy said, pack up your backpacks, pack up your sleeping bags. We're going to take over a building. And 150 of us did that. I don't know why anybody accepted an appointment with 150 people walking into a federal building, but in those days, that was possible.
They're tired. They're grubby. They're uncomfortable, but their spirits are soaring. The squeeze is on, though. Hot water has been turned off on the fourth floor, where the occupation army of cripples has taken over.
So I think in a lot of movements, a lot of us are there because we trust the other people who are there.
Whether there was a Section 504, there was a Brown versus Board of Education.
This is Judy Heumann speaking to Congressman Phil Burton, sent out to hear the protesters' testimony during the occupation.
The harassment, the lack of equity that has been provided for disabled individuals, and that now is even being discussed by the administration, is so intolerable that I can't quite put it into words. I can tell you that every time you raise issues except but equal. The outrage of disabled individuals across the country is going to continue. It is going to be ignited. There will be more takeovers of buildings until finally maybe you begin to understand our position. We will no longer allow the government to oppress disabled individuals. We want the law enforced. We want no more segregation. We will accept no more discussion of segregation. And I would appreciate it if you would stop shaking your head in agreement when I don't think you understand what we are talking about.
There are moments like where history shifts. Judy's interaction with that man is the moment when things shifted for so many people.
I went into the building and I had absolutely no clue why I was there, like none whatsoever. I showed up because I trusted the people that were defining the need.
We had nothing. I didn't have a right to go to school. I didn't have a right to use the library. I didn't have a right to be in a hospital. You know, there was no sign language interpreters. There was no Braille. There was no nothing. What did we have to lose? I mean, really, why not fight? And they couldn't arrest us because if they had put accessibility in place, they could have arrested us. But since there was no accessibility in place, they couldn't arrest us.
One of the ironies of the lack of access at the time was that police vehicles and local jails couldn't handle so many people with wheelchairs. And they didn't have sign language interpreters or documents in Braille for the scores of would-be arrestees.
You know, we were young and stupid, and but we felt invincible because we knew they couldn't arrest us.
The protesters were nothing if not resourceful. They taped cardboard around an office air conditioner to keep people's medications refrigerated. When federal agents cut off the protesters' access to phones and the press, deaf participants stood in the windows and communicated through American Sign Language to interpreters in the streets below.
A day in the life was actually kind of boring in a lot of ways. You know, would wake up in the morning and basically look around to see who needed help. So it was a lot of kind of doing each other's attendant work, helping people get dressed. There were some kids in the building, keeping the kids happy, changing diapers.
Before then, the disability rights movement in the U.S. was mainly dominated by white people in wheelchairs, as Corbett and others have put it. But the 504 sit-in energized a disability community rich in complexity. People with all kinds of disabilities joined the protests nationwide. Outside the federal building, members of the Bay Area's gay and lesbian communities rallied in support, along with representatives of the United Farm Workers and other movements. And there was critical support from the Black Panther Party, founded in Oakland in 1966. The Panthers were widely known as a paramilitary revolutionary group, and by then they'd experienced assassinations and criminal prosecutions of their leaders. But they were much more complex than that. They aligned with women's and gay liberation groups. They ran community health clinics, and they developed a free breakfast program for kids, serving as many as 20,000 meals a week in cities across the country. Here's historian Donna Murch speaking on the PBS NewsHour.
They were arguing that the social welfare state as it existed was not serving the people and that they, as teenagers, could provide free breakfast. When they started the Freedom Schools, so many of the low-income children who went to Panther schools had not had breakfast and they couldn't learn. And so they were shaming the state. And although we don't have the direct documentary evidence, it is thought by many scholars that that shaming of the state prompted the issuing of free school lunch.
One of the 504 sit-in participants was Brad Lomax, a leading member of the Panther Party. Brad used a wheelchair after being diagnosed with MS while attending Howard University. He helped establish the East Oakland Center for Independent Living, and he and his attendant, Chuck Jackson, helped organize the 504 protest as bridges to the Black Panther Party.
The Black Panthers came and offered us food, like on the second day. And in retrospect, I realized that that was the moment when the sit-in was going to be successful. Because without being fed, none of that would have happened. And I happened to be in the meeting room when the Panthers came and asked permission to bring us food. I never met a person who was part of the Black Panther Party before. I'm white, and I was certainly raised not to think that the Panthers were my friends. And I was shocked, and I said to him, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "You're trying to change the way America treats people, and we are all about supporting that." And that moment of kind of cross-community solidarity and the power behind it, not just like, oh yeah, we're gonna let you have an interpreter on our stage, but that we are going to show up every day and bring you food. I understood that. You know, my dad was a fireman. That's a kind of commitment that I could relate to. And to me, that was the moment when history changed. I didn't know it at the time. And then the second part of that was I happened to be in the lobby the next night. And by then the FBI was involved. And they understood that if we got food, they were going to have a problem. The authorities said to them, no, you can't come in. And I watched this man from the Panthers, and he just looked at them very calmly and said, we made a promise to bring these people food. We're not going to let them starve.
I mean, they're totally chill. The FBI is escalating. And, you know, they're saying, you can't come in here. And they said, well, we're only here to deliver food. You know, this can be easy or this can be hard. We will deliver our food and we will leave. If you would like a different scenario to happen, we're happy to bring more people and we could have a very different kind of conversation. And they got in the building and they fed us every single day for 26 days.
Watching them negotiate with somebody that I had been raised to think, if the FBI said no, you just backed right down. And watch it done with such clarity of understanding the power that the Panthers held just by their commitment.
As far as I am personally concerned, there would be no Americans with Disabilities Act, because there would be no Americans with Disabilities Act if there wasn't a 504 sit-in, if 504 hadn't been signed. And to me personally, the civil rights we have, that I have as a disabled person in the United States, is completely tied to that action by the Black Panther Party and their commitment to social justice for us all.
And the disabled people in the HEW building show strength beyond your wildest imagination!
That's Kitty Cohn, a lead organizer of the sit-in. She was part of a group that left the protest after 2 weeks for Washington.
They said, we'll allow you to come to the farthest, most outpost of the official complex of the White House if you promise not to occupy. You have to promise to leave when the meeting's over. So everybody's like, fine, we agree.
We the shut-in or the shut-out. We the hidden, supposedly the frail and the weak, that we could wage a struggle at the highest level of government and win.
And they're about halfway through the meeting, and Kitty's like, I gotta pee. And so at first the staff is like, oh, that's fine, there's a toilet down this hall. Nope. And slowly the staff is walking closer and closer to the Oval Office, because they realize every single bathroom is not accessible, until they finally realize the only wheelchair accessible toilet in the entire complex is inside the Oval Office.
I think that we have written a new page in American history, and we have renewed the old belief in the right and responsibility of people who are oppressed to take matters into their own hands, and that by taking matters into our own hands, victory is possible.
And so Kitty Cohn got the privilege of visiting the Oval Office to use the bathroom. And I can't even imagine the horror of the Secret Service at that point trying to deal with the situation.
Soon after, President Jimmy Carter's administration finally signed the regulations in Section 504. After 4 weeks, the sit-in was over. It would be followed by the Americans with Disabilities Act, and eventually things like Braille elevator buttons and wheelchair-accessible bathrooms would become common, and even accessible police vehicles.
And we won the victory, by God! Nobody gave us anything!
I always go back to that sit-in, because we had won. I mean, who can say that they went up against the United States federal government, occupied a building, and won? There was no downside for us. I mean, for really, like, nobody got arrested, nobody was physically harmed,
The Black Panthers fed us. We were well fed. It was amazing. It was one of those moments that I feel like it shapes a life. It shaped my life.
You'd like to taste a dried apricot?
In her early 40s, Corbett suddenly became a parent.
I just don't have a belief of a cruel God. I feel like if God says, a baby is falling from the sky, you're just supposed to say, okay, and put out your arms and catch.
And that's kind of how it happened.
I had tried to get pregnant when I was in my 30s and couldn't get pregnant. I had talked to people about adoption, but I just didn't have the right life circumstances. And then my friend Atsuko Kawana, who was a woman who had immigrated from Japan, and she and her husband had adopted a child from Japan who had, I think, 2 club feet. And both of them, Atsuko and her husband Michael, used wheelchairs. So they had gone to an adoption agency in Japan that couldn't place disabled kids. And Atsuko turns to me and says, Corbett, would you like a baby? She said that there was a 6-month-old baby, and it was a baby girl, and she was in Japan. And she had cerebral palsy, and she needed a home. So I went to the basic orientations, and the woman who was running it seemed pretty cool. So I said, hypothetically, if someone was gay, would that be a problem? And she said, I've been doing this 20 years. My brother's gay, and I have never seen a person who said they were gay ever be allowed to adopt internationally. There's a question on the form. They will ask you, you have to lie. And if you don't lie, this adoption, I don't care how desperate they are to get into this placement, this adoption will not go through. End of discussion. So that's what I had to do.
As her daughter grew, Corbett faced challenges, but also unique insight as the disabled parent of a disabled child.
Like, I was always looking at my daughter thinking, when she's 25, how's she gonna get around the Bay Area? And I was not thinking she's gonna drive, because she also has a vision disability. So I'm like, okay, so what do people I know that don't drive, how do they get around? Well, they take public transit. So very early on, we were on public transit all the time. I was always looking at her as an adult, but most of the parents of disabled kids were looking at their kids as if they're never gonna be an adult. So you end up with situations where they get put into nursing homes at the age of 12 or 13 or 14 because the parent that lifted them in and out of the bathtub can no longer do it. And there's no community housing options and no way to support the family to keep the kid in the home because that kind of support doesn't exist. I knew too many of those horror stories to want that for my daughter. I wanted her to have life experiences of being in the world as a disabled person, navigating common situations, but also being in an environment where there were work-level expectations, that you don't just kind of like go on your schedule whenever you feel like it. You have a schedule, you show up, you do your job.
Navigating the non-disabled world wasn't the only challenge Corbett faced with her young daughter.
I mean, I think that the main thing that I walked away from as a white mother was how really important it was for her to have community of people that look like her. And I personally think I did a better job on disability because that was the community I was already a part of, and not as good a job getting her connected to Japanese American community. And I have some really good friends that are adoptees, and they also say the question is really, does adoption need to happen? Could those supports be supporting the birth families in a way that helps the kids and gives them a lot of security and a lot less questions and a lot less feelings of displacement. So a black man who was an adoptee talked about, you know, when I was a kid, I was adopted by these very nice white liberal people and they surrounded me with other nice white liberal people. But as I age, that protection of being surrounded by white nice liberal people didn't protect me from the racism.
I asked Corbett what she did to strengthen her daughter's connection to her culture.
I mean, I lived in the Bay Area, so like I'm like a lot of white people. I was aware that there was a need, and I made sure that there were Japanese American people in her life. But it wasn't the same as really having family that was really committed to, you know, teaching her cultural stuff. And that was on me. That was a decision that I You know, the unconscious white privilege, that was me saying, oh, I'm covering disability, that's enough. And really, that wasn't enough. And, you know, that's one of the things, if I was going back again, I would want to very much do differently.
It's summer. I'm with Corbett and our nomad friend Anne in Northern California, hanging out in our vans. We've met up for a weekend of camping at a popular Native American powwow that's held every year on the campus of Stanford University. Since her daughter reached adulthood, Corbett has continued to work with younger generations of disabled youth as a mentor, passing on her skills as an author, publisher, community organizer, and academic.
I feel like for me, the role of elder is that it's time for me to sit on the imaginary rocking chair on the imaginary porch and be available for whoever comes by.
Today, before settling into camp for the night on the powwow grounds, she's speaking to a class at Stanford Law School. They're sitting outside on a brick patio where bird songs mix with the bustle of the university.
Do you guys understand the difference between disability rights and disability justice lens?
I would love to hear your interpretation of that. But yes, they should.
They should.
Yeah.
It's about that person-to-person cross-disability commitment and cross-community commitment. We're all in it together. And that anytime I say that the Black liberation struggle is not my struggle, is a way that I'm cutting myself off from my own liberation, from my own possibility, from my own movement. Because Black disabled people are the movement. Like, it's just, I'm just one little teeny tiny piece of a much broader landscape.
That movement has been propelled by young leaders like Stacy Park Milburn, a disabled, queer Korean American. Stacy and Corbett became not just allies, but friends. Stacy co-coined the term disability justice and founded the Disability Justice Culture Club after moving to the Bay Area in 2011. In 2014, she was named a member of the President's Committee for People with Intellectual Disabilities by Barack Obama. By 2017, Stacy and Corbett, the youth and the elder, were both respected members of the Bay Area's disability community, and they were participating in growing conversations about disability justice. They met up in a recording booth that year to tell the story of their friendship and the movement they've both been part of for years. The conversation starts with them describing their connection as partners in the project.
2017, we are at StoryCorps San Francisco, and my relationship to my partner is that she is a goddess.
My name is Stacy Milburn. I'm 29 years old, and my relationship to my partner is she is a close friend / queer family.
7 years after that conversation took place, Corbett is now sharing Stacy's story in the form of a lesson with the Stanford Law students.
Okay. So this is kind of a legal challenge. I'm just going to give you facts.
Okay.
And I want you to tell me if... No, I want you to tell me, because I don't know the answer. I really don't know the answer. Okay, facts. Person with a physical disability who uses a respirator gets diagnosed in July with stage 1 kidney cancer. No, you can't give it away.
I thought you said you didn't know the answer.
No, she knows the facts.
Oh, got it.
They're hard facts.
Mm. Yeah. So, stage 1 kidney cancer means the cancer has not spread. So that's the facts. That's July.
Experts say the survival rate for stage 1 kidney cancer is 80-93%, and it's generally considered treatable and even curable through surgery and chemotherapy at that stage. But Stacy had also lived with congenital muscular dystrophy all her life.
I grew up not knowing specifically what the condition was, so I walked until about middle school. And then started using a manual chair and then scooter. And then my high school used a power chair. And then 12th grade, that's when I got the trach and started using a ventilator. But as strange as it sounds, throughout that whole time, I never really identified as being a person with a disability.
At the Stanford Law class, Corbett explains that the hospital put in an order requiring that three things be in place at every appointment Stacy had.
I was the medical person, the medical person for this disabled person. I was asked to do their medical research and walk with them through this process.
They would have a team to lift her on and off the examination table from her wheelchair. They would have expert staff to make sure her respirator stayed connected and worked properly the whole time. And she would get extended time for the CAT scan machine.
I think a lot of times society thinks about disability as an individual problem, and it's a way to avoid larger social issues or social responsibility for ableism. And I think for me, I really understood my own disability just through that lens, that it was something to overcome and go to college or do a bunch of surgeries and maybe be less disabled. So much of my childhood memories, I think, are really about surgeries and going to physical therapy, but I didn't really understand why I needed the surgeries. You know, the doctors would say, oh, it's so that you can straighten your neck and be a pretty girl and things like that, but I didn't really care that my neck was a little bit crooked. And then, of course, a few years after the surgery, your neck goes, body does what your body's going to do and goes right back to being the way it was. So they seemed really unnecessary to me, and it was a constant message that I needed to be fixed, and I think it didn't always resonate with me. So then when I found disability community, it was so powerful and shocking, very alarming, that here were all of these people saying that they were fine just as they were, and that actually the problem's not with us, but it's like limited thinking on behalf of society.
So that order goes in August. Multiple attempts were made. The patient went multiple times to the hospital, and either the respiratory therapy wasn't there, the machine wasn't booked for a double appointment, or the lift team didn't show up.
While she waited to start cancer treatment, Stacy continued organizing on behalf of disabled people. Wildfires, smoke, and power outages were ravaging the West Coast. Stacy, with a tracheostomy and ventilator, understood firsthand the critical importance of personal relationships when people like her suddenly lost electricity or were inundated by smoke.
I went to public military schools, and they were fairly small schools, so I didn't have attendance, so I started having that in middle school. But before then, it was mostly teachers that would help me, and so I was walking, but I was falling a lot, and so my family had, for example, strong relationships with, like, the custodian, because she would come into the bathroom and see me sitting there on the floor and then help me get up and, you know, things like that. And one thing I like to remember is my mom would make egg rolls for the whole school to say thank you for helping me. And they were really, really popular, and people would beg her to make them. But I just learned a lot about, I think, like, how do you build relationships with people? Because I saw how much my mom spent time, like, trying to thank people and make them feel appreciated. And then when she did that, I got a lot better access support. I just got to feel like I learned a lot from that.
I mean, this is a person very well networked, lots of advocacy. Like, this is not somebody that doesn't know how to do this stuff. On the phone constantly saying, you know, is everything lined up? Three different times they were assured by the care coordinator for the whole da-da-da-da-da.
By then, it's early 2020, just weeks before the whole world grinds to a halt due to COVID-19. Our response to the pandemic in the U.S. and around the world would reflect our collective disregard for people with disabilities. Pandemic triage policies meant hospitals often prioritized the able-bodied over the disabled, rationalizing that their survival was more valuable. Some states argued that these policies directly violated Section 504, the very regulations disabled people like Corbett fought so hard for. But even before the pandemic really took hold, Stacy was still waiting to get into the hospital.
February. We get to February. Now the person has been sick. The cancer has advanced to stage 3, which means it's gotten metastatic.
I think in my own life, I'm thinking, I feel like the last 10 years or longer have just been around, like, finding, like, beauty and power in myself. And I want people to know and find that for themselves, too.
And then in May, the person, basically you can move to stage three and it's going to keep progressing, so you maybe got whatever a year. And the person was 32 years old when this is happening. Or you can try surgery, but you know, you're pretty compromised. Have the surgery, 2 days later they die. On their 33rd birthday, death is all complications from surgery.
I mean, legally, I don't know, but morally, the system's responsible.
Well, but what I'm saying is, I pose it because this is the kind of lives disabled people are leading. And there's no liability. I mean, as far from a legal perspective, there's nobody to hold accountable. I don't even mean like money, I just mean literally morally accountable. There's no moral accountability of this.
Stacy's death left a profound void in the disability justice movement, and her legacy continues to spark waves of compassionate community organizing. Just days before she died, Stacy was still mobilizing with four other queer disabled people of color. They put together nearly 100 COVID protection kits with homemade disinfectant, vitamins, and N95 masks that they distributed at homeless encampments.
What does it mean? I mean, Stacy was one of our, like once in a generation leaders. I mean, absolutely. To me, it's these areas that when disabled people are trying to have conversations with non-disabled people in all kinds of professions, these are the kinds of real-life things that are happening that we've got nowhere to go.
I would want people with disabilities 20 years from now to not think that they're broken, you know, not think that there's anything spiritually or physically or emotionally wrong with them, you know. And not just people with disabilities, but queer people and gender nonconforming folks and people of color and all of the people I think that society really, like, pushes down and out. And, yeah, just to know, you know, like, we're so powerful, and I want people to know that.
And beautiful.
Yes.
And resourceful.
Yes.
And sexy.
Yep.
I think there's a high likelihood they're going to come for us again. You know, that things are going to change and that they're going to come really hard for disabled people. And I'm like, who's going to be left to protest? I mean, Stacy, the people in my generation raised a group of leaders behind us for real.
Like being with you here, like, this is fabulous, you know. If we were non-disabled, the likelihood we would know each other is pretty small. You know, we come from different parts of America, we're different races, we're different ages. There's a lot in society that says we shouldn't be friends. And yet, I treasure this connection, not just because you and I are women that use wheelchairs, but also because we share this love of creative ways of thinking about stuff, and also the joy we have in being in the bodies that you and I inhabit. In a way that I think that the world doesn't really see that for the most part.
Never thought of that. That we wouldn't have been friends. It's, yeah, mind-blowing.
And I don't even know what to... I mean, I don't even know what to do with the rage. I mean, for real. Like, when people say, you know, well, you're awfully angry. I'm like, yeah, I am. Yeah. Yeah.
As an elder, Corbett keeps finding ways to empower others.
I don't care what you do, but do something. Make the world a better place. I think that's a realistic expectation we can have for everybody. And I think that people expect disabled people to never do that. And I think that the legacy of 504 is that I came out of the building knowing in my bones we took down the federal government. That was a huge accomplishment. We did not do it alone. That's what I want to help other people know, whatever their 504 moment is.
And then, just a few days after we camped together at the Stanford powwow, Corbett lost her home on wheels.
Yeah. She was just getting the final touches done at a mechanic, just a few tune-up kind of things.
That's right.
That's Brenda from Minnesota again. chatting with Kyle from Van Aid. They both helped renovate Corbett's van.
And it was stolen right out of the lot at the mechanic shop.
It was devastating to hear that news. Yes. After everything that she put into that van, mm-hmm. you know, and that the whole team put in.
We're sitting on a porch in Berkeley as she tells me what happened.
It's all gone. Basically, the way I explain it to people in sticks and bricks is my house burned to the ground and everything was lost. And the fact that it was stolen by people who were joyriding and living in it and then stealing stuff, it doesn't matter what happened. Functionally, my home is gone. My home burned to the ground, functionally. All my personal stuff. You know, stuff from my daughter, you know, like when she was a baby, I had a few. You know how it is when you're a nomad? Everything becomes smaller and more precious, and I had like one little box with like my passport and her birth certificate and like her first pacifier and just a few things, pictures of people that are dead. You know, just things that meant a lot to me. They had no commercial value whatsoever. I mean, the passport might have, but everything else, and everything was gone.
Her friends put together a GoFundMe campaign.
And people were astounding. I mean, the generosity was really, really, really astounding how quickly we raised the money and how many people. I think it ended up being like 375 people. Really, it was a huge, huge, huge group of people.
Corbett was able to buy a 2001 GMC Savannah that had been used to transport disabled people from jail to a county courthouse. When she got it, the van still had bars on the windows, and you could read the faded word probation on the side.
It's kind of a trip that people with disabilities have been transported in it. It's kind of like its next life is going to be to travel the country and be healed by nature.
It needs a ton of work, but there's another Van Aid coming up. Corbett also bought a boxy trailer that she can fix up to tow behind it. She even wants to build a fold-down deck so she and Anne can sit outside and watch the sunset. Oh yeah, she and Anne became a couple.
When she kind of found me, she hung around a bit, and then she at one point said, "You know, I'm flirting with you." And I was like, "Nope, I have no idea."
You didn't notice.
I thought she was being friendly, but she was, but it has progressed, keeps getting deep. The words have deeper meanings all the time.
I remember one day I thought, oh, I'll go out and visit and hang out with her for a little while. There were always people around,
yeah.
Right? I mean, all kinds of people. And she treated every single person as if they were like the person she most wished had appeared at that moment.
Yeah.
And that kind of kindness is really deeply moving to me.
I'm back with Corbett and Anne in the desert. It's been a rough year for both of them. Anne lost her brother unexpectedly. Her beloved cat, Meshuggah, also passed away, and her truck camper was totaled in an accident. A kind acquaintance later gave her an old camper van, and she's slowly fixing it up, parked side by side with Corbett. I often see Anne sitting in a wheelchair outside their vans, knitting beanie caps for anyone who wants one. She's made hundreds of beanies and given them all away. That's Anne.
This is wool, mohair silk wool. So the deal is you have to hand wash it.
Okay.
If you don't, it will become about that big.
Okay.
Because of the wool.
You can't put it in the dryer.
To an outside observer like me, theirs looks like a very challenging life. It's nothing like the glamorous hashtag van life you might see on Instagram or YouTube.
My reality is that this is a one-way ticket for me. I don't get to sit back and be off.
You know, kind of regardless of what happened, I'm so glad to be back out in the desert. I'm so glad to be back out in nature. Being outside and just watching the sun go across the sky in the day just makes me really happy. And, you know, we sit out here most nights and watch the sunset and sometimes stay long enough to watch the stars come out. It depends on how cold it is. But, like, everything else just kind of disappears in terms of importance. And
You know, that to me, that healing power of nature that is just always available, whether it's at the ocean or in the desert or in the sky, like that's the way for me personally to reset. And, you know, all these people, you know, stuff happens, stuff's happened to me, stuff's happened to Anne, stuff's happening in the world, and I don't have the energy to do those fights if I don't have this.
Corbett has me seeing our van-dwelling community in a different light. There are people here who've built comfortable lives around their disabilities. Others are just trying to outpace the progression of disabilities as they age.
Do you consider yourself part of the disability community, however you might interpret that phrase?
We all have our little shortcomings or disabilities, but I personally don't think myself I'm in the disability community or disabled community.
I do, although I may not be involved in many, you know, actual disability groups. I do consider myself to have disabilities, sure.
No, I can do pretty much anything I need to do. I mean, I do have some emotional things, but I don't consider myself disabled. I don't take label, so. Well, I had an injury a few years ago, and it sort of gave me a whiplash, messed up a couple of nerves in my neck, and also left me with PTSD. But for the most part, I can do everything I need to do, so.
But you don't call yourself disabled?
Not yet. I'm sure I will in a few years as things catch up with me. I mean, I understand the need for it, especially if you do need assistance for stuff, but labels kind of, they kind of bother me.
Okay.
It seems like a lot of the problems that come from living with disability really come from a world that expects people not to ever be disabled, or to only be disabled in certain ways, like needing glasses or hearing aids. Yet the World Health Organization estimates 16% of people have a significant disability. That's 1 in 6 of us. Among people 60 and older, it's 46%, nearly half. In reality, many of the challenges faced by disabled people are often design problems that could be resolved if we approached others with a deep sense of curiosity and empathy.
I mean, I've seen it called everything from like radical hospitality to just honored guest. Like, I want to invite you into my space, into my life. I want to get to know you better. What can I do to make that easier? If we have curiosity, not just about people with disabilities, but if we have curiosity about each other, each other's lives, and we're looking at it as human connections of hospitality. You know, the person I invite to something, maybe somebody that stays in my life may not, but I don't want their experience of their time with me to be something where I made them feel uncomfortable because of my thoughtlessness, and all I have to do is ask.
Corbett still finds inspiration in the words and work of her friend, mentee, and mentor, Stacy Park Milburn.
You know, when she ran workshops, she would always say to everybody, okay, we're going to name, da da da, and any access needs you have right now. And people would be like, well, I'm not disabled. And she says, no, it's not about that. Everybody has access needs. Everybody has a body, therefore everybody needs something. You know, do you need it cooler or warmer? Do you need lights on or off? Do you need... And I think we pigeonhole that information in disability. Oh, only disabled people need accommodations. Well, all bodies need to feel comfortable and all people need to feel welcome. I want a world where we know that we're fabulous and that we're not alone and that the system is set up to treat us and channel us as disposable human beings who have to basically have permission to be in public space. I want us to know that that is wrong. We're not wrong. We're not broken. That is wrong. And for me, that's the work. I'm not changing systems. I'm not changing that world. I'm changing our world. Because we live our power, and then the world around us is forced to change in relation to that. Empowered disabled people are the change agents. That's all I really care about. I want disabled people to know that they are fabulous as they are, that they have superpowers, that they are survivors just by being out of an institution today.
I often say my generation is the first generation that has the possibility of living our entire lives outside an institution. But it depends, to me, on those of us that can talk about this stuff, being out there talking about this stuff.
It's a week after the November 2024 election. I've just spent a couple of days driving a van full of medical supplies from the Bay Area to another Van Aid event in Arizona. Anne will use them when she sets up her free clinic table.
I just want to invite people to remember, I mean, this is what we know as nomads, is everybody's got something to contribute, and everybody wants to contribute, and everybody has a way to contribute. It's a matter of you inviting them to connect with you to contribute. Like, there's a lot of reasons we could be in conflict with each other as human beings, but post-election, my big concern is that so much of the country has been taught we're enemies of each other. The question is not what happens now. The question is, what can I do to help with whatever what happens now? What can you do, and what are you willing to do? In the bigger puzzle, if everybody's doing something, it all gets done.
This episode was co-produced by me and Gray Area's creative director, Mara J. Reynolds, with field recording by guest reporter Brenda Zorn. Special thanks to the producers of Crip Camp, and special thanks to Alice Wong of the Disability Visibility Project, as well as StoryCorps, for helping us find Stacey and Corbett's 2017 interview. We have links to those resources and much, much more in our show notes at grayareapodcast.com, and that's gray with an A. We also have information about a new federal lawsuit filed by 17 states that's currently challenging parts of Section 504. Travels with Corbett was produced as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's California Health Equity Fellowship. Be sure to check out the first audio documentary in our series on elders, titled Uncle John. And a shout-out to our colleague Nancy Marie Spears, because that episode won the 2024 Breaking Barriers Award from the Institute for Nonprofit News. For Gray Area, I'm Julie Reynolds, and this is Season 3, Elders. And for the final word, here's artist, educator, and disability activist T.L. Lewis.
I'm just going to run down some brief statistics that are available online. Children with disabilities are 3 times more likely to be placed in foster care than those without disabilities. Children with disabilities are 4 times more likely to be living in poverty than those without disabilities. Children with disabilities are 50% more likely to drop out of school than those without disabilities. Children with disabilities enter the juvenile system at 5 to 6 times the rate of youth who do not have disabilities. The largest mental health providers in the nation are jails. Blacks and Latinos make up 30% of the U.S. population, but 60% of the incarcerated population. And now 20% of our population here in the United States, of course, has disabilities. We represent 60 to 80% of those who are incarcerated in jails and prisons across the nation. So at the end of the day, what that means is people with disabilities are the largest minority population in jails and prisons, period.